Okay. Well, again, I want to say how delighted I am to have Steph Fubach with us. Let me remind you, Steph is the director of Special Needs Ministries for our denomination through a mission to North America, and lives fairly near us in Lancaster or in Ephrata. Is it in Ephrata you live or Lancaster?
Yeah, Ephrata area.
In Ephrata area. And we're reaching our concluding four-part series, and today she's going to talk to us about families and how we help our families move towards living a new normal life.
Right.
Is that, you have to explain to us a bit what is meant by new. Is that a different type of normal life?
Or right, a new sense of normalcy, right? That family doesn't stay in the crisis forever, as they might feel when they first get the diagnosis. And going back to that imagery I set up, I think at the end of the first segment when we talked about what we typically would like to see is a nice linear path, and instead we get a convoluted highway, that this all these different phases are concurrent. Mm-hmm. There's a level to which they're concurrent, right? So you have both the onset and even the beginning of the developing of new normalcy and acceptance all going on at the same time. They don't just happen sequentially. One of the things I failed to mention at the end, which I think will segue well into this at the end of the last section, is that rushed resolution results in resignation. Remember, we said we don't want to have resignation because it's a counterfeit piece, but rushed resolution ends up pushing people into a place of resignation. And we've seen this happen before. An easy way to think of a familiar experience with that is when a family member might die, and we give people 30 days to grieve, right? So we don't really give them the time they need. We tend to put our own timetables on someone's acceptance. And rush resolution has a tendency to result in resignation. And what we really love the other person and what we want them to experience is peace, then we will take the time that it takes to come to genuine resolution and not resignation. Living a new normal life is really, as we talked about in the whole area of acceptance, is accepting, embracing life as it is, not as we wish it was, and helping a family then just find their stride. How does a family find its stride, find its new rhythm, you know, in the context of the situation that they find themselves in? Helen Featherstone's written a book called A Difference in the Family. While it's not a Christian text, it's probably one of those honest assessments I've seen of a family life with a child with a disability. And she uses a saying that says, differences differ only in degree from those of other families. And I like to start this section with that quote, because when you think about the differences that families affected by disability experience, it's much easier to identify with them if we remember that we just extrapolate them from our own experiences. So, and you'll see as you'll go through each one of these things in this section, you'll say, I've dealt with this. And so it's not so hard if you are able to say, well, this is the way I've experienced this particular type of thing before, now extrapolate it to a difference of degree, and then anticipate what that might be like, or how I might feel in that situation. Mm-hmm. So that, again, keeps us from that other type of mentality. My life is not wholly different than yours. There's a difference of degree. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about, in terms of onset, that the family goes through this 9/11 experience. What happens is a family starts to develop more of a sense of new normal. What needs to happen is going from a tendency to see the situation as a crisis to seeing one's life as a life in need of supports. Okay, and the analogy I like to make to this is that my son Tim, my son with Down syndrome, when he was about 5 or 6, we were visiting a friend's house for the weekend, and Tim was running around their house with a lightsaber, and he was swashbuckling, you know, his way around the house. And he came up to me very upset because the lightsaber, the light didn't work in it. So I looked at it, and I needed a new bulb or battery, whatever. I couldn't fix it. What's that? It needed the force. That's right. And so, there's an analogy there too, isn't it? And so, anyway, I looked at it and said, you know, I know you'd like it to have the light, but, you know, it's going to work without it. You still play with it. You're okay. So I sent him off to play, and he's gone for a little bit. About 5 minutes later, he comes back in, and he says, Mom, it's a phone, it's for you. And I'm thinking, how could the phone be for me? This isn't my house. You know, and it's a landline phone, and we didn't have a cell phone at that time. And he said, no, he kept very insistent, it's for you. So I went in the other room, and sure enough, there's the phone, you know, landline phone on the cord, and he hands it to me, and on the other end is a 911 operator, right? And in that characteristic measly voice, he's like, "Hello, ma'am. We've had an emergency phone call." And she said, "We understand that there's someone in the house choking on a lifesaver." And I said, "No, there's no one here choking on a lifesaver." She goes, "We've dispatched an ambulance." Now I'm getting panicky, right? So I'm like, no. And I'm glaring at Tim the whole time because I initiated this phone call. So I finally talk her into the fact that, no, indeed, there is no one choking on a lifesaver, that we do not need an ambulance, and I hang up the phone. And I looked at Tim, and I said, "What were you thinking?" And he lifts up his lightsaber, and he says, "I had a broken lightsaber." So he had called the 911 operator to tell her that he had a broken lightsaber, and he wanted her to fix it. And she misunderstood him, that he was choking on a lifesaver. So anyway, but the
seems
point...
like an emergency.
Exactly, and that's what the point is that he saw that as a crisis, when in reality it was just something where he needed assistance. Right. And
children, do not try this at home.
That's right. Yeah, we developed a first name relationship with the 911 operator for a while. But anyway, that is an important distinction, and I think that kind of creates a picture of what families in this phase need to come to terms with. This is not new normal. Doesn't necessarily require 911 intervention. Right. All of life is not a crisis here. There's an element on which, whether it may be consistent difficulty, what's needed is supports, non-ambulance. Okay, and so when we look at different differences of degree here, we'll talk through some of those, and we'll talk at the end how do you set up good boundaries and all in order to help a family move from a crisis orientation to one that recognizes that it needs supports. The first one is the idea of personal care. And again, these are extrapolations, right? So we all know that when you have an infant in the family, they're obviously going to need to be diapered and fed. Mm-hmm. And we all expect that we should do that for, say, 2 years. And then a child becomes relatively more independent, self-feeding, toileting. But for a child, a family affected by disability, depending on the person's disability, personal care type of issues can last a lifetime. Right, you may have to feed, bathe, dress, diaper an adult into their lifetime. So there's a difference of degree here. So that's one of those new normal things, that you may have extended responsibilities of care that can last throughout a lifetime. Medical care, of course, is another personal care type of issue, and this not only relates to disability but to chronic illness as well, right? All of us are accustomed to going to the doctor. We can all identify with that, but the difference of degree in terms of the number of doctor's appointments, the volume of specialists involved, and the amount of regulated care is much greater. And so that's what the family has to learn, to step up and absorb that change. The next thing is the whole subject of education. While all parents want to see their children receive a good education, children with disabilities often enter into the educational experience much earlier, as early as a month or 2 months old, into early intervention. So while a typical family will be able to have a child home, say, till they enter kindergarten, with a family affected by disability, that child may enter his schooling at 5 weeks and not 5 years old. So there's a whole level at which education ratchets up, and the involvement, there's just a level of complexity that comes with all of those therapists as well. God bless the therapists. I'm so thankful for the ones that we had that really enhanced Tim's quality of life. Another thing related to education is also the idea of Christian schooling. You know, it's often people have strong opinions. Christians have strong opinions have strong opinions about the subject of education and Christian schooling. And yet the accessibility of Christian schooling for children affected by disabilities is incredibly limited. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I often tell people is, if you're on the board of a Christian school, think through what are your covenantal responsibilities to children with disabilities. How can you open up more opportunities for them to be involved. And if you're a parent who has very strong opinions about Christian education, be careful about black and white categories of what's right and what's wrong when you're not willing to offer that to all children. And so education just becomes another area of a difference of degree in terms of the amount of energy that a family will put into that. Third one is behavior. And, of course, all parents want to raise their children be respectful and to be socially engaging with other people and to honor God in the way that they handle themselves. And yet their behavior becomes a very complex thing with certain types of disabilities. And often makes us also extremely uncomfortable because we have difficulty understanding where the line is between disability and volition. And so behavioral issues can create a huge amount of stress for families, and yet it becomes, dealing with that has to become absorbed and incorporated as part of the normal challenges that family faces, often to a difference of degree. And you see this often, especially with children with autism, right? Children with intellectual disabilities. When we would meet with Tim's teaching team every year, one of the things that we would always stress was that don't always interpret resistance as defiance, right? That sometimes for a person with an intellectual disability, noncompliance can come from not genuinely understanding what's being asked or being asked to transition in ways that are faster than that person can cope with. Same thing with a person with a communication disorder. Sometimes the way in which a person may act out in order to try to communicate, what we would call act out, in order to try to communicate, may be their only way of communicating, and yet we might interpret that negatively. So it's difficult, and there are no easy answers to know where lines start and stop with behavior and communication. And yet, those become very much regular issues in the life of a family. For me personally, this was probably one of the most exhausting areas to deal with on a regular basis and accept that as a normal part of life. Tim was a very busy guy mm-hmm. when he was younger, and often very, very challenging. Children with Down syndrome often have what sometimes I used to call reverse zest. Which is code for stubborn sometimes. and yet, when I started to understand, when I started to see the world more through Tim's eyes, and I saw what he needed, what he needed to be successful at adapting to a situation, I stopped looking at it as stubbornness. I gave it the moral value of stubbornness, mm-hmm. and instead seeing, providing him the supports he needed to succeed, and to give him the time he might need to transition, the information he might need to interact in the situation.
I've seen that with families in our church of children with developmental issues, and it is that particular thing about, is my child willfully
sure.
misbehaving?
Sure.
Does it have to do with a particular disability?
Sure.
And that's is a very difficult one for them.
And what makes it even harder is when a parent already is struggling, I don't know where this line is, and then they're receiving judgment, or they're perceiving at least that they're receiving judgment on the part of other people who may be observing.
That's right. And too, I mean, all parents struggle
right.
with behavioral issues of their children and discipline,
right.
and they go back from feeling guilty to I'm not being hard enough, I'm being
right.
too lenient, and so
right.
on. But it's only probably more complex and magnified a bit
yes.
in your children.
Yes, so, right, so that's a great example, because it's not wholly other, it's just a difference of degree.
Yeah.
And the whole idea, too, you know, with your typical kids, you will often get to a point where you have a system that's working for you, and just as you start to feel comfortable with that, they go to another developmental
right.
stage where you need to rethink your methods. And
it's also very difficult if you have other children. And
right. Right. Then you get into questions of equity. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it brings up a good point. You know, sometimes people will ask me in a seminar, "What does that mean? Kids with disabilities get a pass? You know, they get mm-hmm. a get out of jail free card, right?" And I say, "No, that's not." That's not what I'm saying. That's not in their best interest.
Right.
All children need need loving discipline, but it's going to take a lot more, it's going to require a lot more of you and I to move out of our own comfort zone in order to lovingly make that happen. Mm. So, but really trying to withhold judgment, which often comes out of our own discomfort, right? Yeah. We observe a situation, we're uncomfortable with what's going on, so we start to make judgments about that. The next one is time management. And again, this is, I'm not going to dwell on this a lot, but all of us in the modern society, rapid moving 21st century, struggle with time management issues. And you can see by just looking at all these other elements we talked about that time management for a family affected by disability just becomes more of a struggle as you try to add more doctor's appointments, more therapy appointments, more time to do personal care, more time that it takes to do discipline. And at the same time, trying to make sure you spend quality time with your other children, right? Trying to keep that all in balance. Which brings up an interesting point, too, in terms of helping families as they're trying to find this new normal state. A family has to come to some sense of what is enough, right? And remember that this was a normal part of life in an abnormal world, and it's not about fixing it, right? It's about bringing restoration into the lives of the families, and it's already not yet context. It can be helpful to help families let go of some perfect ideal, you know, of what some therapy regimen or whatever is going to look like. I know as a family, we kind of came to that point where we said, how much time are we going to invest in therapy for Tim, and how much time really, you only have so many hours in the day. You know, how are we going to strike a balance here so that the whole family is a healthy system, not Tim at our expense and not us at Tim's expense. And so you have to come to some terms of limitations of time and giving up ideals of perfection, whether it's in what inclusive schooling might look like or what certain kind of therapies might look like. Social isolation is another one. We talked about social issues in the onset. Every family, in terms of a social life, has different elements, a different degree of engagement that they choose. And the difference with disabilities often, what happens is that social isolation occurs from time to time, not by choice. And that's where the distinction is. And so, for example, when a family member might have a cognitive disability, again, we talked about the discomfort level, sometimes if people back away, you know, don't know what to say, don't know what to do, limit engagement they would have had otherwise. Over the course of a lifetime, when you're in this more steady state, families can experience an element of social isolation that's not voluntary. Mm-hmm. The same type of thing can happen with a family who has chronic illness. Someone in the family has a chronic illness, and that person's very susceptible to infection. There can be a certain amount of isolation that by definition has to happen in order to protect that family member from debilitating illness. So the social isolation, and another thing you think about is just complexity of, for example, if you're home making dinner at 5 o'clock and you forget an ingredient to the recipe, it's annoying. You know, if you have to get in the car and go get that recipe, it's more difficult if you have to get toddlers in the car in a car seat. It becomes extremely difficult if you have to get a child with CP in a wheelchair into the van in the right? So that there's a social isolation that occurs just because of complexity due to transportation. I'm sorry?
And it's raining.
Yes, right, exactly. And weather, that's right. We have folks at our church who use wheelchairs that don't come on, they're weather dependent, right? Mm-hmm. Because getting in and out of the van and from home on an icy ramp and all these kind of things can affect mobility. So, but I guess one of the big things, and I'll tie into the next point with this, in terms of social isolation is what happens sometimes tragically in churches, is where churches will have a family who, say, has a child with autism or a child with behavioral issues, or maybe an adult family member with mental illness, where there's difficult complexity in socially relating to that person, and they get asked to not come back. That I have heard countless stories from people who get asked specifically to not return to their congregation. And so you can just imagine the degree of painful isolation that comes when that type of treatment happens. This next idea is this idea of access and advocacy, and that's that every family, of course, wants their children to have opportunities to succeed in life and opportunities to experience different things in life. And that's a typical family dynamic. For children affected by disabilities, access and advocacy requires a whole another level of energy, because often you have to overcome that social dimension, right, of disability, that the stigmatizing, disabling because of cultural and societal views part of disability. And that means advocating in order to have your child in Cub Scouts, or have your child in youth group, or have your child in the local elementary school. It doesn't matter what the law says. You still have to often advocate to actually have it carried out. And of course, as Christians, we don't want to be driven by law. We want to be driven by love, right? And so we want to do the right thing for the right reasons because we care, not because someone had to force us to do it. And so my encouragement to the church in that sense is that the accessibility issues is that people with disabilities have to advocate so many different areas of their lives. Let's make the church the last place in the world where they have to work hard to get in. Let's be the ones who set the example for what that access can look like.
Well, that's been a process for our church. Mm-hmm. And you walked in our church, you walked the three flights of those stairs to get up here, which someone, depending upon their disability, can't come up here.
Right.
And over the years, we've had, this is where our building committee, we've had mm-hmm. architects, and one in particular who's well-versed in what the needs are and the codes, mm-hmm. and gradually start adding handrails here, yeah. and ramp one place, and now we've made the commitment to spend over $1 million to put in an elevator.
Yeah, that's great.
And that's great. That takes a lot of, a lot of it is just really what you're actually doing mm-hmm. right now is helping to make us aware mm-hmm. of what we just don't think about.
Mm-hmm. Right, so we haven't experienced that difference.
And then prodding us right. a little bit right. to keep thinking about it, because yeah. it's easy enough to think about it one day, and then there's so many other things, and then just keep mm-hmm. it in.
Our pastor at RPC tells a story about our church is in a renovated fire hall. So we had the same type of thing, a lot of stairs, old building. Mm-hmm. And when we built a new addition, there apparently was a lot of struggle over the amount of money that needed to be spent to make it disability accessible. Mm-hmm. And but Tom talks about how when we had a Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, and John, who's a member of our congregation who has spina bifida, wheeled up that expensive ramp, and gave the call to worship. It was just so powerful. And to see the body of Christ led in worship by John, and what the sacrifice, the quote-unquote sacrifice financially of making the building accessible to him was worth every penny of it. So. And then family relationships. Again, we talked about this at the beginning. I started off with this at the first point at the beginning. This is basically the last point of the last one. One of the most helpful pieces of advice I got when Tim was a baby was from our minister of pastoral care, who came to visit me in the hospital. Tim was in there with bacterial spinal meningitis and then almost died. And this was his third or fourth hospitalization in 12 weeks. And what he talked to me about was the whole idea of a pie of life, that every family has a pie, and that when you have a family member with a disability, by definition, their slice of the pie is going to be a larger slice of pie, but still you have to be careful to keep that pie in balance as much as possible. Another way that was tremendously helpful in terms of thinking through different decisions, like I talked about earlier, in terms of how much therapy, how much time. And another way I've thought about it since then sometimes is, as you know, how when you get your tires balanced, right? If there's weights on, you know how your tires, you can tell when your tires are out of balance because wop, 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 right? The car just feels funny. And so trying to find where do we need to put the weights around the outside of the rim. and making sure that God stays at the center of that wheel, that God's the axle, so to speak, and not the child. It's very easy when you have, or the person with a disability, it's very easy when you have a person in a family that has high needs for them to become the center. And that's actually, when you think about it, is a form of idolatry when any person becomes the center of the family system. And God himself needs to be the center of it, and is finding out how do we distribute those weights, you know, around the circumference of that wheel that brings balance to family life. And while I did mention earlier that there is a high divorce rate for families affected by disability, and that is something we need to be sensitive to, and I think we can help bring that down by providing practical supports. And at the same time, though, the presence of disability in life of family is, again, not an entirely negative experience at all. And it can bring stronger marriages and much more sensitive and caring siblings. You know, I see so many different families where disability has been a tremendous blessing in the life of the family, and so I want to make sure that we keep a balanced perspective on that. And as far as how can you help? How do you help a family stay out of this 911, right? Crisis-oriented mentality and step into a steady state of appropriate independence? And I'd say there's basically five different short points I want to make. The first one is the idea of engagement. You need to stay engaged. You need to be where they are, right? If they're, you can't just wait till they come to church. Be engaged intentionally with the family, because for all these other reasons we mentioned, there may be times they don't get to church, right? Or everything from access to transportation, right, to medical issues, etc. The second is to use good boundaries. One of my favorite books that's been helpful to me on this is Townsend and Cloud's book on boundaries. Mm-hmm. They talk in there about Galatians 6, where those verses in Galatians 6 talk about carry each other's burdens, each man must carry his own load. And they differentiate between, and I'm not a Greek scholar, so I'm not going to try to do this, but they differentiate between the meaning of the word burden and the meaning of the word load. So when it says carry each other's burdens, this idea of a boulder, something that's so heavy that if you don't have assistance carrying it, it will crush you. We use a ministry tool at our church called Covenant Care Groups, and what we set those up for families that are authentically in a crisis situation, a sustained crisis, to keep a boulder from crushing them. That said, the whole idea of a new normal life is saying each man must carry his own load. Each family must carry their own backpack, right? Mm-hmm. Disability brings with it a backpack. It does have some weight, right? Sometimes it's a substantial amount of weight. But when you get to the point it's not going to crush you, you do have to develop the muscles to carry it. Mm-hmm. And when we don't do families a service if we don't help them to develop those muscles by good boundaries. And again, that you stay away from the extremes of abandonment or boundary violating intrusion, right? And try to find what that balance looks like. That said, good boundary relationships to a family that's in a steady state will involve assistance. It will involve bringing practical assistance, doing things that support siblings, making sure that parents get out and have downtime and respite time. Providing transportation, practical things, learning how to drive a handicap accessible van so that you can take a family member who's disabled somewhere. Not just a doctor's appointment, but maybe out to have some fun, right? And then giving encouragement. Again, these are all, I think I often say that biblical encouragement is one of the most powerful gifts that God gives us in the scriptures, and yes, one of the ones that we most neglect, I think. Encouragement can take a person so far. Mm-hmm. And while a person may have a heavy backpack to carry, when we are walking alongside of them, encouraging them in the process of doing that, they will make it, down that path. And again, the last point being perspective. When we talked at the end last time, being modeling Jesus, living a life of grace and truth in the context of walking alongside a person. Everybody loses their perspective sometimes. And so even in the steady state, we need truth tellers and mercy givers in our lives. And all of us need that. All of us need someone who will speak God's truth into our lives and be merciful and gracious in the way that they do that. They'll help us pull us back, right? Give us a reorientation, a new perspective that we need, and help us wind up and, you know, move along to the next thing. And part of that is, part of that whole perspective process, I think, is the last point I want to make, is knowing when you have run out of your resources to provide perspective, and maybe you need to bring in some type of professional help. That maybe there's an underlying issue at hand here that may be beyond your means or my means to address it, and bringing in someone who has specific expertise in that particular area.
I want to back up a little bit on one of those about encouragement. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's say I had received a while back an email from someone who had been in a marathon.
Yeah.
And telling his story. And basically, the story was he wasn't going to make it.
Yeah.
And what happened was just another runner kind of latched onto him.
Yeah.
And encouraged him, mm-hmm. you know, come on, you can do it, you got to go further. And, mm-hmm. and what struck me as I was reading it is, in one essence, the other runner, I mean, the encourager, did nothing.
Right.
I mean, he didn't carry him, he didn't pull him, he didn't give him anything, he gave him more energy or mm-hmm. whatever. All he did was just be there for him and speak to him whatever he needed to hear at that moment, whether it was to, you know, yes, you can do it, or come on, it's just a little bit more. And that's all it was.
And had the effect of carrying
him. It was just mental.
Right.
And he had within himself the ability to do it, but he needed someone to encourage him.
Yes.
And it's the same thing that's one thing that we can provide for our families.
Yes.
We may not have expertise.
Right. And you have to remember, the families didn't have expertise either. You know, nobody comes into this with a PhD in disability, right, before the onset.
And I found for myself the best encouragement is you just listen to someone, mm-hmm. talk about all their troubles, and more often than not, when they're done, they feel better.
Right.
And you haven't even said anything,
right.
And they end up thanking me for what I haven't said.
Yeah.
Thinking I had said something right. instead.
One of the things I remember being incredibly helpful to us when Tim was little, two particular things. One, I remember just notes that people would send. They might send just a card of encouragement, postcard, something that simple. And the other thing was just affirmation over areas where he was improving. So, for example, Tim always liked to sit in the front row at church, which is sort of a vulnerable place to be when you have a child. Had some behavioral challenges, and so when he was younger, it was, you know, we always said that part of our ministry to the church was sitting in the front row so that other parents felt better about how their kids were doing in church. But one of the most encouraging things to me was, as Tim matured, to so many families that came up to us, it was so great to see how Tim's learning to sit through the whole service. You know, he was wanted, he was welcome, and then he was affirmed. Mm-hmm. As he continued to grow in his ability to participate more and more in the worship setting. And that was such an encouraging thing to me as a parent, because that was a very challenging thing to continue to reinforce positive, encourage positive behavior there. And as we started to succeed at that, it's actually here that someone noticed, that they noticed that it had occurred, and they believed in us that we could get to the next stage. That's enough energy to keep me going to the next step.
So. Well, thank you for coming and providing some affirmation for us. This is encouraging to be receiving some training and help. You know, we do have, I want to remind you that we have a special needs ministries team or committee, and David Apple's providing oversight of that. Kristen Hartley is pretty much providing a good leadership for that. And they are quite happy. If you want them to come and speak with you, if you need some more resources and so on, they have good access to that. And please make use of them. And again, to remind you, you may be at home individually watching these sessions and and still thinking, and did as I asked you to do, thinking of a particular family and still feeling overwhelmed. But you're part of a team. You're part of a parish team. And you don't have to take on anything by yourself. And there are others who have the gifts you do not have. There are times when you're going to be tired yourself, as Steph spoke about, and you let others come in and take your place. But we're going to be in this together. So thanks again for listening in.